Page 1, reel 44. I was asking if the enemy had any casualties and on in the raid on C Squadron.
As I say, I don't know. But on the 11th of July, I had an interesting day. I was told to go and establish the village of Viscina. Viscina, that was occupied by the Germans, and to find out what strength, and also to port on a bridge crossing the river between Valfabric and Casa Casalva. And so I moved off at first light in a Daimler Scout car.
On your own?
On my own, yes. Mm. And my route took me through some pretty rough, rocky tracks. Mm. And I was going down one of these tracks. It was quite steep, that led down to the river. And going head to go slowly, because I was like going down steps almost, mm. and these rocks. And unfortunately, my steering arm broke, must have caught a rock, and so I couldn't go any further. So I thought, oh, well, that's my patrol finished for the day. So I got on the radio and told the squad leader. And he said, oh, well, stay where you are, I'll send up some alternative transport. So I hung on, and in due course, it arrived. In the form of Lance Corporal Noble, who was a groom, had been a groom before the war, riding a horse and leading another one for me. My word. And I think I was wearing shorts at the time, it being so hot. And, I took the mobile radio with me. Left my driver with the vehicle to await recovery, and mounted the horse.
Had you learned to ride?
No.
You'd never ridden before?
No. And off we set.
Did Lance Corporal Noble give you any instruction in the arts of how to steer a horse?
I said, keep close to me. And anyway, up we went. And I think the horses were pretty docile anyway.
So do you know where they've been acquired from?
No, but I knew we had them. You know, we had them set up. We had some mules as well around about that same time. So they were sort of, I think, fairly well trained. Mm. So, as I say, off we went. And down this, so I got to the river and I saw the bridge had been demolished, and all around I could see the S mines were dotted around in the countryside. Mm. Well, my word, I don't want this force to get out of control. Mm. Yeah, I want to steer clear of this, because if he'd gone treading through it, I don't know what would happen.
Well, you'd gone up on a mine, wouldn't you?
I sort of kept well back, and I could see the bridge was completely demolishing. So I went further downstream, and we forded the river with Noble at the side of me, and off we went. See? And we got onto open ground eventually, and I felt so naked, sort of sitting up on the horse, having been in an armoured car, going towards where the enemy were in this village, which was a few mile away, which I would have done in an armoured car with no problem at all. And the closer I got to the village, the more and more concerned I was that I was a sitting target. And when I got to about 2 miles from the village, I thought, right, this is enough. So I said to Noble, right, you sit underneath this tree with the horses. I'm going ahead on my own by foot. And so off I went, and I went along the hedgerows or ditches and that, and I got just outside the village, and so was in the ditch, and alongside the road, and so taking a peek, and I saw an Italian, and I said to hey, don't eat the Tedesco, my Italian. Tedesco beer. And he pointed to the far end of the village. Tedesco beer. So I said, okay, off I went crawling down the length of the village till I got to the far end, and so I kept popping up and have a look. And then in the distance, you know, 200 or 300 yards away, I saw two German six-wheeled sort of vehicles, personnel carrier type thing, you know. And they were not six-wheeled, they were track. Two wheels in the front, half track.
Half track, yeah.
And a number of German troops around them. Nothing much I could do about it anyway. Mm. But I could see them now. And I think there was about 20 infantry all together. Mm. And I couldn't make out, you know, what they were doing. They were not in any strong points or, you know, in positions or anything. They were just standing around their vehicle. And I thought, well, not much I can do. I just had my Smith & Wesson pistol. I don't think I could have charged them and sort of taken them prisoner or anything. So I just laid there and just observed. And after about an hour, they all mounted the vehicles and off they went, out of the village, and disappeared. So I gave them a little bit of time, and about 20 minutes or so, sort of got my nerve back a little bit, and sort of had a good look around to make sure there's nothing else around, and made sure that the village was clear. And I made my way back to Noble and the horses.
You found your way back all right.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
Did you see any other Italians about?
No.
Just the one.
I didn't sort of pay much attention, really. Yeah. I just looked as in, and I assumed that those Germans were the last people in the village to leave.
Yeah.
And instead of coming back through the village the way I'd gone, I cut across to, you know, and I was pretty certain by then the Germans had left. That's my main concern. I think most of the villagers probably were. The heads down in the houses, and got back to the horses, and so rode back like John Wayne, I suppose, and got back to my vehicle, which was still there, and sort of got on the radio and. Passed all the information that I had, and I was very tired, very stiff, and I allowed Noble to take the horse back with him, and I waited for the recovery. By then, because it was late afternoon.
What had your driver been doing while you'd been off, just waiting by the vehicle?
Yeah, he was sleeping at it. But there was nothing he could do anyway. And so the recovery arrived and got us back. Mm.
Did the recovery do a repair on the spot, or did they tow you away?
No, they lifted us back, because they couldn't do it, because on the ground as it was, and so they just took the vehicle on, and there was a scandal, and lifted us or
what. What did the scandal do? I mean, was it a low loader that could carry a car?
No,
or
they just had to lift up.
Yes.
The back. You can't, I don't know whether they told you, but they took the wheels off the front and lifted us and took us away. So by the time I got back to headquarters at squadron, it was late evening, and I got out of very stiff and sore. So to say, it's not a I know I joined a cavalry regiment, but I didn't expect to have a.
Was that your only mounted action, that patrol, or did
it
you do others?
I think it was, yes. I didn't want any more.
You didn't? No. You didn't take to riding?
No, really. Not under those conditions. You know, when you're sitting up there, it's all right when you're in an armoured car, you've got a certain amount of protection. You know, if a shot comes over, you drop, or a shell comes, you know, you're inside, you've got a certain amount of protection. But on a horse, there wasn't a lot.
Of course, that is the traditional role, isn't it, for the light cavalry? It's reconnaissance.
Yeah. I mean, that's what they did in the Boer War and places like that, more so, didn't they?
They did. First World War as well, to a certain extent.
Yeah. I think we were in the Mons Moy was the last charge they did with the Lions. But anyway, the next day I was off on patrol again at dawn. But things were back to normal. And there was poor half light and visibility down to the lowest actually. I think it must have been a mist or something. And everyone was sort of nerves fully stretched. So I was getting with a lack of sleep and quite a strain on everybody, not only the commanders but the drivers and the gunners and everyone involved, you know, sort of reflected. And of course, being in the armoured car, the heat
beating down.
I mean, at least the commander could have his head out and when you were moving at a certain amount of air, but the gunner was sort of like in another, and the driver really didn't get a lot of he had a little visor which was open, so he got a little air, but with the heat on all day, and if you were stationary, as we were quite a lot observing, the command got on top, you know, got some air, but the poor old driver and gunner, they were like being in an oven.
They needed a draft through the vehicle then to cool them down.
Not only when you were moving.
When you were moving.
Stationary then. And there was a patrol near Skrito. We picked up two civilians. And they were rather suspicious. So they were sent back to field security section for questioning.
Why were they suspicious?
I don't know. I'm not sure which troop picked them up, but they were doing something and acting in a very suspicious manner, you know, but they might well have been sort of being cautious and creeping along, you know, because of the situation. But, you know, I think on the safe side, they were sent back to field security to check them over. I suppose we hadn't seen a lot of civilians about, and those that we did see, if they were brave enough to come out, they were probably treated as suspicious.
Well, the ones who came out with bottles of wine and flowers they didn't have the proper equipment for welcoming.
No. But then, by then, we were progressing towards Gubbio, which is a medieval town with a big monastery on the outskirts. And progress was very slow. And D Squadron were on our left flank, and they were encountering demolitions and obstacles. I think that was the squadron John Clark Kennedy was commanding, the squadron then, I think. And so things very difficult for them, and the mountain roads were very slow and difficult. But on the outskirts of Gogo, there was this monastery, and inside of which were herded about 200 townspeople. And they were under the threat of death should any advance be made on Gogo. And that was taken quite seriously, actually.
How did you know about that?
I don't know. It came back through...
come up through the rear link?
No. It came back from... Because we were there in front.
Mm-hmm.
And we passed it on. And I think eventually, I know, it came out that when they got back to a liaison or something. But we weren't to advance any more, and they had to negotiate with the general commanding the garrison about they wouldn't attack because these civilians were going to be killed if we did. And then, in fact, I think something in the regimental history about it, that they even went back to the Pope, went to that level diplomacy in order to save these people in the monastery at Gogo.
But surely by threatening to kill them if you advanced, this German officer was committing a war crime, wasn't he?
Yes, yes. Mm. And in fact, I don't know how far it went. I know it went back to quite high diplomatic things through the Vatican, because all these people who got in the monastery were Catholic.
Mm.
And they were hostage. It says even the Vatican was approached to assist, but the enemy commander had certainly delayed any advance for quite a few days, and eventually withdrew his force into the hills north of the town. So that meant we could then go on into Gogo. But it was quite a big incident, really.
What happened to the actual hostages? Had they been left behind?
They were freed eventually, after the Germans sort of had secured the delay they wanted.
Mm.
Things then went back to normal.
Mm. What were you doing then during that enforced period of delay?
We just had to sit and observe. You know, from a distance, you couldn't do anything, because the hostages were at risk.
Mm.
So the old trooper sort of said, right, hold your positions where you are. I don't know why they wanted this, probably a few days extra delay. It's a very interesting that, really. But we still were sending out patrols.
Did you see anything significant on those patrols? Any significant enemy activity?
They did make contact on some of them, and a foot patrol, a corporal Dougal from the squadron, failed to return, and presumed he'd been taken prisoner. So, you had your little contact, but there was a case, I think.
There? Feedback.
Okay. C Squadron came to relieve us after round about this time, and the squadron moved to the area of Ambatidi, which was the north of Perugia. We had a bit of time here to sleep, bathe, change the clothing, and sort of really get ourselves a bit more sociable, and sort of did a bit of maintenance on the guns and the vehicles. And then from here, as we had time off, we were free. I decided, with the squad leader's permission, of course, to borrow his jeep and drive back to have a good look at Foligno. So this we did, and I drove the jeep.
So was this your first leave since the time when you took off from Algiers to go?
Yeah, more or less, yeah. Yes. It wasn't a leave, I was out for a day, but we were free, you know, we didn't have any commitment. And so I drove and I took three of my friends with me, I think three or four. And I think we took one or two bottles of gin. Mm. And we made for Foligno. We passed through past the CC, and we didn't go up and look, but we could see it up on our left as we took. And we had a wander around the town, could sort of get a chance to look at it, and some of the places where we sort of, the railway station and things like that. And this time we could do it at leisure. Just when we were here, we met up with the local Parmesan group, and they'd set up their office sort of bits of the north of the town in a hut in the mountains.
But by now, of course, they were in the liberated area, weren't
they? That's right, yes. And so they invited us there, and they entertained us with wine and a lovely meal, and roast goose and spaghetti, and it really looked after us very well. Probably had a little bit too much wine. And as it started to get dark, we thought, well, it's about time we got back and rejoined the squadron.
How far had you had to go then to get to Foligno?
Around about 25 miles. And of course, being a long way back from the front, it was normal practice to use your headlights and switch them off when you got a bit too close. I think wine was a bit stronger than I thought, anyway, so I was travelling along the road. Well, no other traffic on the road, of course, so I mean, I wasn't a danger to anybody.
So you were driving?
I was driving. Mm. So, the road was well illuminated with my headlights, so it was pretty fast progress we made back. And, you know, we were all in a very happy mood. And suddenly, around us, shells were exploding all over the place. God, so I switched off my headlights. And did a 3-point turn. And apparently, I've missed the turning. I should have done. And I flew straight towards the enemy lines. And when they saw the headlights coming, they must have wondered what the devil was going on. Mm-hmm. So they put down a stonk.
Did you suffer any damage?
Well, splinters all over. The radio was put out of action, and lots of damage on the vehicle, but to us, nothing, not a thing.
Mm. Sounds like a very lucky escape.
Yeah, and as we came back, you know, from the dinner time, got shooting straight back, where we met up with four Hussars. And they'd been startled when we shot by in our Jeep with our headlights on. Mm-hmm. And they thought, what the devil is thing? They were, I think, just as surprised as the enemy were. Mm-hmm. But as I say, we got away with it, except when we got back.
What happened then?
We would do is go off out on back into the line, I think the next day, and the radio was riddled with shrapnel and parts of the vehicle, so it was a case of getting the fitters on it and everything, and getting everything back to normal, and that was it. It was quite an adventure, but very fortunate, we were very lucky, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, probably having our headlights on probably saved us, otherwise I think we might have gone straight into it.
You might have driven right into the enemy lines and been caught.
Wondered what was happening and sort of laid down this shell fire. Mm. So it's all very exciting, I think. And also, fantastic that we weren't, none of us were injured. There's sort of different things of the war, you know, these sort of things where you could have lost all of us on the vehicle by a stupid mistake, really.
Who else was on the vehicle with you then? Who'd gone back with you at home?
There was Jimmy Purvis, Sergeant White, who was a sergeant, and Sherrard, who was a sergeant, and then there was another, because there were five of us, and another, no, who was the other one? Sherrard, White, oh, Jordan.
And you were all from B Squadron.
All from B Squadron.
And so that's a sergeant major and four sergeants.
Could have been wiped out.
Yeah.
Which would have been quite a lot to replace in a, in one squadron anyway. But anyway, it was just one of those things where someone was shining a light on it. And on the 22nd of July, we were all ready and prepared, and we went into the front line east of Chitty Castello. Again, at this time, as infantry.
Well, back to so back this is your second time as infantry.
That's right, because we were up in the hills and the mountains, and so it wasn't an infantry, it wasn't an armed car area. And a unit of the Indian Division equipped us with mules to transport our equipment up to the top of the hills. So we had to sort of learn a little bit, although they had the handlers with them, we had to sort of get used to the mules carrying all the kit up onto the, on the hills for quite steep positions we had to hold.
Were the positions already there when you arrived? Were you relieving another unit?
No, I don't think we were relieving, we were making them.
So you actually had to dig?
Yes.
That was something with which you were a bit unfamiliar, wasn't it?
I don't think there was much digging to do, but it was just occupying the high ground. That's the thing, really. Something, again, not our normal role, but in a position where we could probably observe.
Was it the same kind of thing as you've been doing at Castello Sangro?
Much the same, although these positions were set in Sangro, that we'd taken over from the infantry, and we were overlooking a definite place where the enemy were. There was a static line, so this was slightly different. We weren't sure what was ahead, and that wasn't going to be static anyway.
So was your role just to hold? And,
I think hold, observe, and move forward if you could.
Alright. So you were then perhaps expected to do infantry attacks as well as holding ground?
No, I don't think we were been equipped for that sort of thing. We weren't trained for actual infantry attack. I think repel, but not to go forward as infantry people. I don't think that would have been expected of us. Because after all, we weren't trained in that.
What weapons did you have up on there?
Mainly the machine guns and a couple of mortars, that sort of thing, and sort of personal arms, rifles, and nothing. Well, we couldn't have anything too heavy. We didn't have it, but we could take up brain guns.
What could you see then, looking forward from those positions?
Not a great deal. You might have at one position might have an open plain in front of it, and sort of might see a road in the distance or. I think each position had a different type of view. Not necessarily a good field of fire.
What about your squadron sector? What was ahead of that?
Sort of like a valley. You're up on a hill and sort of low ground in front of you. And sort of a hill's rising in the back. So it's probably about a couple of thousand yards with a valley, and you could probably see track going up in the hills.
So you've got a valley and then high ground beyond.
That's right, yes.
Any sign of the enemy or their activities?
Not to any great strength. You might see an odd vehicle streaking around, but nothing near. But you could hear lots of bombardment shells coming over mainly dropping along in the valleys, and, but not necessarily on us.
And what living conditions like up on that session?
A bit big and many.